This is a moment to seize. The kaleidoscope has been shaken. The pieces are in flux. Soon they will settle again. Before they do, let us reorder this world around us. That was Tony Blair on the 2nd of October 2001, 5 days before the American and British invasion of Afghanistan. And now we all know how that story ended up. So, Tom, we thought we would devote this week's podcast to a survey of Afghan history, didn't we? Explain some of the background to the events that we've been seeing in the last few days and to ask some of these sort of big questions about, can empires ever intervene in Afghanistan? Is it an inherently lawless and violent place, or is that just a series of kind of cliches?
And also, this episode will serve as an introduction to a much more focused episode, which will follow tomorrow with Willie Dalrymple, looking specifically at the episode that people often kind of compare to what's going on today, which is the first Afghan war, absolutely calamitous disaster in the history of British imperialism. But I do think that the talk of Afghanistan as a graveyard of empires, of which obviously, for obvious reasons, there's a great deal at the moment, occludes the way in which Afghanistan has also been a great womb of empires.
Yeah.
If you pull the camera back, this way in which imperial powers kind of gestate within Afghanistan, and then they kind of come out down the Khyber Pass, invade northern India, settle there, become kind of enervated and soft, and then the cycle repeats. I mean, that's an equally kind of resonant pattern that you can trace through history.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And also, when people say, they talk about the sort of medieval barbarism of the Taliban and so on. I mean, actually, the irony is that in the medieval period, Afghanistan was actually a very sophisticated and civilized place.
And indeed, an ancient history as well.
So let's put it into a bit of context. And actually, I know we both agree about this, that the single most important thing is to get a sense of geography, because geography comes before history, famously.
Yes. And so actually, as we're sitting here, I've got a map right in front of me. And crucially, it doesn't just show the cities, it shows the mountains. Because Afghanistan's quite a kind of odd country. It's not, I think, a kind of natural nation state in the way, say, that England might be.
Denmark.
You know, Denmark. You can trace the contour. So Afghanistan has a massive range of mountains running right the way through the middle of it. And the key cities kind of basically exist in relationship to that. So the northern kind of flatlands, the north of these mountain range, in very ancient times was known as Bactria. And the southern range, the kind of deserts that you have there, were known as Arachosia.
Yeah.
So you've got Herat in the far west, you've got Kandahar in the far south, and you've got Kabul in a kind of a valley which it links to what is now Pakistan.
So kind of bold.
But you have these massive mountains in the middle, and that is really the kind of the key factor, I think, that you have to bear in mind. I mean, wouldn't you agree? I think absolutely geography is destiny.
And actually the geography, because of that geography that you have the ethnic mix. So the ethnic mix is a massive part of the story of modern Afghanistan, certainly. So Pashtuns, what are they, about 40%? And then you've got Tajiks, Hazaras, Uzbeks, and other smaller groups of people. So in other words, it's not one homogenous kind of community of Afghans. It is competing people who speak different languages. And often, you know, their antagonists are each other rather than outsiders necessarily.
And that reflects the fact that it's a crossroads and, you know, strategically absolutely key, coming from all kinds of directions. So India, we've mentioned, and it's kind of very obvious at the moment. But also there are trade links to China, to the Stans, to the north, and I think crucially to Iran. So yeah, I think Persia is absolutely massive, massive influence. And if Ali Ansari was here, who did that kind of wonderful podcast for us on the ways that Persia has influenced history, he would have no doubt in saying that Persia is probably the kind of decisive influence on the way that what is now Afghanistan has evolved. And really, what is now Afghanistan first emerges into history with the great Persian Empire.
So that's the empire of Cyrus the Great.
Cyrus the Great, Darius the Great, emerges in the 6th century BC, endures until Alexander conquers it. And Bactria, as I mentioned, is the kind of the northern lands that lie above the kind of central mountain range in Afghanistan. And then beyond that, Sogdiana into what's now Uzbekistan. Those are satrapies or provinces of the great Persian king.
Yeah.
And from the point of view of what happens when the Persian Empire falls, what's interesting about it is that it's a place where Greeks get exiled. So Miletus, the great city on the Aegean, on what's now Turkey, the Milesians rebel against the Persians, and city gets destroyed. And the Milesians get exiled to Sogdiana, so north of Bactria. But other Greeks get exiled into Bactria.
Afghanistan. It's what's now Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of Siberia then. It's the sort
of
Persia's Siberia.
Yes.
You get sent there if they're putting you out of harm's way as a sort of punishment.
Yeah, absolutely. And it means that, although, I mean, they become kind of loyal subjects of the Persian king. The Bactrians, you know, people talk about how Afghanistan is a land that is the graveyard of empires. It isn't the graveyard of Persian imperialism. I mean, it remains a part of the Persian Empire for 2 centuries, basically,
which is why
Alexander turns up, he takes for granted that now that he is the great king, he's conquered the Persian Empire, these lands belong to him.
Well, so this is an amazing story, isn't it? So Alexander has conquered Egypt, the Levant, the Persian heartland, and the Persian king Darius has been killed. And the guy who killed him, Bessus, his base is in Bactria, and he's shot off to Bactria and says, I'm the great king now. And he goes off to his heartland, sort of over the Afghan mountains. And Alexander does what most normal people most normal people would say, I've finished now, I'm the great king, I shall go and enjoy myself in the palace. But Alexander follows him, doesn't he? He goes all the way over the mountains, past Kabul, this crazy expedition.
And captures Bessus.
Which in complete contravention to everything that you read in the newspapers, is a roaring success, right?
Yes,
I mean, it takes him a very long time, but he wins.
Yes, he does. He does. And also he with the modesty for which he's famed, he founds an enormous number of cities, all named Alexandria after himself, some of which are, you know, famous cities to this day. So Kandahar is one of the cities that he founded.
Is that Alexandria in Arachosia? Is it? Or is
But Kandahar, obviously Sikandar, you know, you can see the kind of the derivation. Ghazni, which becomes a crucial, really, really important city in the early years of the Muslim conquest. That's Alexandria in Oppiana. Even beyond Afghanistan, so further north, you've got Alexandria Eskete, Alexandria the furthest, which is kind of the outer limits of Greek civilization. And then you have this city, Alexandria on the Oxus, which after Alexander has died and his general Seleucus takes over the kind of the vast bulk of the Persian Empire, there's this kind of renegade satrap who basically casts off his loyalty to the distant Seleucid Empire and establishes this kingdom, this Bactrian Greek kingdom that survives for centuries. And actually is independent long after Greece and the Macedonian realms have been conquered by the Romans.
And this is, yes, it's like something from a video game, isn't it? It's like something from a strategy game.
Well, I think it's like a science fiction story. It's kind of like those science fiction stories where there are Earth colonists on Mars and then the Earth blows up and you've only got this colony left. So there's this amazing city that they found, I think, in the 70s. That were being excavated by French archaeologists when the Soviets invaded in 1979 and they had to stop. And then they went back in the 90s and again they had to stop. But it's this extraordinary Greek city. So that's in the, looking at the map, it's the kind of the northeast region of what is now Afghanistan in the shadow of the mountains. And it's this great Greek city with theatres and with temples.
Is that
it's kind of an amazing image of Kybele, who fans of the World Cup of Gods will remember, the worst wedding in of all time. So she's portrayed. And
is this Aykanum? Is it called Aykanum?
That's right, yes, which means Lady Moon in Uzbek, apparently.
Right. And they found, have they found bilingual coins, I read? Amazing. So half in one side is in Greek and the other side is in a sacred Buddhist language or something.
Well, what also happens is that gets destroyed, I think, in the 140s, something like that. But
right.
There is another, there's a kind of Indian Greek kingdom that is now in what's northern Pakistan, but includes a lot of what is currently Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And in complex ways that I would not want to tease out, because I'm really not qualified to do it. Greek cultural artistic influences inform the development of Buddhist art.
Yeah,
which
I've
is starting
that.
To come up from North India into what is now Afghanistan. And there's all this kind of that the smile of Apollo becomes the smile of the Buddha.
That's absolutely fascinating, I think.
Yeah, it is fascinating, and it's very complicated and very controversial. So
the listeners can't see this, but I can see that you're nervous about it, which tantalizes me.
Well, it's much debated, and I wouldn't want to pretend that I.
But at this point, Tom, I mean, there's a couple of things that occur to me. One is that Alexander did conquer Afghanistan, so you can't not conquer
as
it.
As the Persians had done.
As the Persians had done. And the second thing is that it's clearly not ludicrously violent and lawless, because, as you say, the Greco-Bactrian kingdom lasts for centuries.
Yes, and it gets destroyed by kind of, you know, nomadic raiders coming in from the north, which is another kind of perpetual theme, that Afghanistan on its northern flank is open to nomadic armies. And that's what wipes out Iconum.
But also the idea that Afghanistan is, that you see very much in the newspapers now, Afghanistan is kind of presented as the antithesis of kind of Western values and so on. But obviously, there's a point in ancient history, it was a haven of Western art and religion and, you know, people stripping off in the gymnasiums and doing what they do. And
into the early Middle Ages as well. So it becomes a kind of one of the great centres of Buddhism. And the famous place that, you know, is Bamiyan, with the two extraordinary sculptures there that go up, I think, in 550 AD, 610. And you get records of Chinese travellers, you know, Buddhists who are coming, and they report that there are multitudes of monasteries there in Bamiyan, that Buddhism has become, I think, kind of arrives there first, second centuries AD, and by the sixth, by the seventh centuries, it's become this great center for Buddhist civilization. So absolutely, it's a meeting place as well as a place where people kind of clash and fight.
Because the Silk Road is basically skirting the northern flank of Afghanistan, isn't it? So the Bukhara, Tashkent, Khiva, Samarkand. I mean, they're to the north, but obviously that influence must come south and into
Bamiyan is in the mountains, and I think it's on a road that enables the kind of, you know, there's a mountain route that takes you to China as well. So that's its significance, and that's why people from China, you know, Buddhists from China come and meet there. But then, of course, it's not good news for Buddhism in the long run, because with the emergence of Islam, you have Islamic armies turning up, and actually takes quite a long time for what will become Afghanistan to be Islamized. So the first great Islamic kingdom has as its focus Ghazni, which is Alexandria in Opiana, this Alexandrian foundation. And it's this is the kind of the first great Islamic kingdom. But even then, it's open to all kinds of invasions. So the 1150, it gets sacked by this terrifying Tajik conqueror who calls himself the World Burner.
The World Burner. It's very
the World Burner,
kind of Game of Thrones type nickname.
Well, it's so Game of Thrones. He makes the inhabitants carry the earth of their sacked city to his capital, which is a place called Firoz Koh in the mountains of Gore. I'm just reading that off. I have no idea where that is, but it sounds great. And they carry the soil of Ghazni all the way to Firoz Koh in the mountains of Gore. And you know what the World Burner does then?
He covers them with the soil or something. Or
no, he butchers them. And he mixes their blood with the soil. And he uses it as mortar to build victory towers.
Wow. That is,
So if we're giving the impression that this is all, you know, that, that in the medieval time it's all hippies hanging out, it is
all people painting exquisite miniatures.
There's an enormous amount of slaughter going on.
Yes, but as there is everywhere, to be fair. I mean, it's not like there's not lots of slaughter elsewhere.
But I think the sense that at any moment terrifying hordes of invaders, kind of Dothraki-type invaders, might sweep down. I mean, that is, you know, you compared it to a computer game. That is the jeopardy that might strike at any minute. And of course, the famous ones are the Mongols.
So when do they? What point do they pitch up? So they've conquered China, presumably, and they haven't yet got to Europe.
No, I think that Afghanistan is the first target.
Oh, right. Okay.
I think.
Because of the wealth of its cities and so on, I suppose.
No, because they insult Genghis Khan's ambassadors.
Oh, that's absolute folly.
I think Genghis Khan sends ambassadors saying, let's be friends. And
People always do that with the Mongols, don't they? Don't they do that in Baghdad and places like that? They say, they're inconsequential. We can insult them with impunity.
They singe the beards of the Mongol ambassadors and send them back to Genghis Khan.
That's reckless.
Which is not sensible. And so...
Right.
Everything, it all gets horribly wrong. So you mentioned the Hazaras. So they are kind of almost certainly Mongols who are part of this kind of sweep, and they're up in the mountains, and they become Shia Muslims.
Yeah,
and that's why the Buddhas of Bamiyan survive, because the Shia are much more tolerant of statuary and visual representation.
Yeah.
If they were Sunni Muslim, perhaps they'd be less tolerant of the statues, but there they are. So that's a further part of the kind of the mix of what will become Afghanistan.
So at this point, there's no sense of Afghanistan as Afghanistan. It's merely a province of other people's empires, by and large.
I'm not sure that people would even be thinking in terms of provinces. I mean, it's peoples, it's cities, and you have this kind of constant swirl of empires that rise and fall. So you also have Timur.
So that's Tamerlane. That's
Tamerlane, Timur the Lame, hero of Marlowe's great play. Is it not passing brave to be a king and ride in triumph through Persepolis? But he also rides in triumph through many of the great cities of Afghanistan. One of the cool things that his troops do is that they toboggan down the side of a mountain on their shields.
That's very impressive.
It's very impressive, isn't it?
It's both fearsome and pleasingly childlike.
Yes, exactly. So these kind of, you know, these cycles of kind of terrifyingly imperially minded warlords coming from the north culminates in the Mughals.
But before you go on to the Mughals, Tom, the Tamerlane, am I not right in thinking that... under the Timurid rule, Herat or Afghanistan was a very successful, buoyant place. And the Herat in particular, which is an Alexandrian foundation, Alexandrian area, I think. Robert Byron, the great travel writer, sort of classic early 20th century travel writer, in his book, The Road to Oxiana, he says, you know, Herat is amazing. It's beautiful. It's the Florence of the kind of Eastern world. And they are all sort of, you know, doing astronomy and, you know, building lovely minarets and all this sort of stuff. So at that point, Afghanistan is actually, or what becomes Afghanistan, is very civilized, right?
I think it's this fusion of all these various peoples who've come down and Persia. So, these are great monuments to the enduring influence of Persian civilization. And Herat, Kandahar... You know, these are, it's easy to go from the heartland, the Persian heartlands up, you know, there are no mountains in the way blocking you off. And so the Persian influence is so strong and so overwhelming that's really what these cities are monuments to, I think. Although I've never been to them. I mean, it's a kind of enduring dream to go and visit them ever since.
Probably not.
I wouldn't
book a holiday.
Not the time now. But in a way, when, I suppose when you kind of conjure up images of Central Asia, those are the great mosques, the great towers, the great monuments. Those are what come into your mind. And absolutely, I mean, that's a crucial part of a history of what will become Afghanistan. And we keep saying what will become Afghanistan because it hasn't yet become Afghanistan. And that's really why it's the Mughals.
Yeah, sorry, I took you off from the Mughals.
Who are kind of the link between that medieval world and the world of the early modern that will become, in due course, the world of British India and indeed of Tsarist Russia.
Yeah.
So the key figure of the Mughals, the founder is a guy called Babur, who claims descent from both Genghis Khan and Tamerlane. And he's kind of contemporary of Henry VIII, Francis I, Charles V, all those kind of early 16th century guys in Europe. And he feels that he basically identifies with, he doesn't look south, he looks north. So he feels that he's been exiled from Samarkand, the towers of Samarkand. He wants them back. And he has this kind of irredentist yearning. He wants to reclaim them. But instead, he ends up conquering Kabul.
Right.
And this is really where Kabul enters the story. And Kabul provides easy access down into the flatlands of the south, into the Punjab and
so to Pakistan,
North India,
basically.
Yeah, into what will become Pakistan. And he conquers Kabul. And he praises it a place where you can go in a single day to a place where the snow never falls. And in 2 hours, you can also reach a place where the snow never melts.
So very good.
Something for all tastes.
Yeah.
And he spends two decades basically consolidating his rule in Kabul. And then he does what anyone would do after two decades of consolidating rule in Kabul. He conquers Delhi.
Right. Wow. So he's little known in the West, but obviously an enormously impressive empire builder. To go Kabul to Delhi is not a small hop. It's quite a leap.
Yeah. And so from that point on, the Mughals basically are centered in Delhi. And Kabul becomes peripheral. I mean, it serves as a summer capital. So on occasion, the Mughal emperors will go up to Kabul to get away from the heats of the Indian plains. But, it's not the center of gravity. And that, of course, is basically what then sets up the great dramas of the 18th and 19th century.
Yeah. So that gives you a sense, doesn't it, of Afghanistan being pulled in different directions. So you talked about Persia, but obviously then India. I mean, presumably once you've got the Mughal Empire, then the center of gravity has moved south towards India. And you get a sense, don't you, of at that point that you made about the crossroads, being pulled in, there are different cultural influences, but obviously there are different imperial powers who see this as a important part of their sort of, their realm, their hegemony.
Yeah. So by the 18th century, to the north, you've got Tsarist Russia, which is starting to expand southwards. You've got the decaying empire of the Mughals in North India,
which is being eaten by the East India Company.
But also by Persia. And you remember the episode on the East India Company where this terrifying Persian conqueror, Nadir Shah, suddenly storms out of Persia, defeats the Mughals at the great Battle of Karnal in 1739 and captures Delhi and basically carts off the entire Mughal treasury to Persia. And that enables Nadir Shah to establish himself as probably, the ruler of the greatest empire of the 1750s. This incredible power. And one of the warlords who gets absorbed into his empire is a guy called Ahmed Khan. And he is he's a Pashtun from the region of Kandahar. So he is in the south of the kind of the great central mountain range of Afghanistan. And he, rather like the Ottomans, kind of take, conquer children into their train and train them to be Janissaries. He's the son of a conquered opponent who is in the train of Nadir Shah. And in 1747, Nadir Shah is assassinated in northern Persia. And Ahmed Khan is with a kind of posse of fellow Pashtuns, and they grab the Koh-i-Noor, which is the great diamond that Nadir Shah had taken from the Mughals. And he takes it and a whole load of treasure up to Kandahar. And he uses the treasure, he parcels the treasure out to all the kind of various warlords, and he establishes himself as, you know, the big cheese. And this really is where Afghanistan starts to emerge. I mean, Afghanistan is not a word that the Afghans themselves use, but Afghan is the Persian word for Pashtun.
Right. So you've got a Pashtun empire or kingdom for the first time.
Yeah. And the word Afghan is an ancient one in Persia. So the Sassanid Empire, which is the great empire that emerges on the eastern flank of the Roman Empire in the 3rd century AD, in those early years, so back in the 3rd century AD, you have inscriptions referring to Afghans as okay. the people who, right. you know, who live around what will become Kandahar. And intriguingly, just as in the West, you have kind of, you know, the Irish or the Scots or whoever lay claim to a descent from biblical figures, so also do the Afghans.
Who are they descended from?
Well, they claim to be descended from somebody called Afghana, who is the grandson of the biblical king Saul, and who was the chief general under Solomon.
Is that... I don't remember him.
It's completely made up.
Right.
He's a completely made up figure to explain why they're called Afghans. But you do...
Saul wouldn't be the person I'd choose, because isn't he...
Yeah, I mean, he comes to a horrible end.
Yeah. I mean, he's not the first person from the Bible I'd choose a descent from.
Well, whatever. But he's still biblical, which is quite classy.
Fair enough.
Through the 16th and 17th centuries into the 18th century, you do have these traditions that the Pashtuns are actually descended from the Israelites.
Well, that
from
I
the
did
lost
not,
tribes of Israel.
I did not know that. That's a very that's bizarre.
I don't think something the Taliban really major on.
No.
The fact that
no.
they're all actually all
No, I can't imagine
descended
that
from the tribes of Israel. But that was a kind of enduring story. And so you know, it's so interesting how in the Islamic world, as in the kind of early medieval Christian world, you have this kind of desire for emergent peoples, emergent empires to lay claim to this kind of ancient pedigree.
Yeah.
Is you know, it's something that kind of joins East and West. Really interesting. And it becomes important for this guy, Ahmed Khan, who takes on the name Duri Duran, the Pearl of Pearls. And he disguises the fact that basically his tribe is taking over by changing the name of his tribe to Durrani. So, you know.
The Pearl of Pearls. I might choose that.
I might start
I start referring to myself as that. I think that's a good one.
Yeah, it's a magnificent title, yeah. Isn't it? And so he established this kind of Durrani kingship, which basically, you know, wedged in between Persia, wedged in between the Mughal Empire, wedged in between Russia, it's starting to take on some of the lineaments of modern Afghanistan.
Yeah.
I mean, it's actually larger than modern Afghanistan, so it includes a large chunk of what is now Pakistan. But it's a very, you know, it's for the first time you're getting a kind of Afghan polity.
Right.
You know, and Duri Duran is very successful. Duran Duran, as perhaps
we haven't had a Duran Duran reference for many episodes. So I'm glad that I wouldn't have expected this would be the place we'd get it in, but
unexpected development.
I'm glad you've surprised me.
And do you know how he dies?
He's eaten by a wolf.
He has an ulcer on his nose and it goes septic.
Oh, that's kind of banal,
so
but also horrible.
His nose gets eaten up, ulcerates.
Right. Okay. I'm sure there's some metaphor there, but I don't know what it's for. So this sort of cues up the great game, because the great game is coming, isn't it?
It does, because what happens is that his descendants, his grandson, his son and his grandson, they lose territory to the emergent Sikh Empire.
Yeah.
And you remember we had Satnam Sangera on.
We did.
Talking about the inequities of imperialism.
Unbelievably formidable the Sikhs are.
Well, and we asked Satnam, how did people feel about Sikh imperialism? And we know how the Afghans felt about Sikh imperialism, which is namely that they weren't in favour of it.
Right.
Because the Sikhs nicked a vast swathe of their territory. And so the son and the grandson of Duri Durrani were very keen to get it back. And they failed.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the context. And as you say, this is part of a much larger game, which involves, of course, Persia to the south, Tsarist Russia to the north, but now increasingly what we have to describe as British India.
Yes, of course, because, I mean, this is the great game, isn't it? And some of our listeners will have read those books by Peter Hopkirk. Wonderful books. I remember reading them when I was a teenager and just being utterly captivated. These stories of British agents or East India Company agents kind of crossing these mountain passes and descending on these khanates. They're basically James Bond figures.
They are. And anyone who has read Willie Dalrymple's Return of a King will know that this is absolutely the kind of the context for the first British invasion of Afghanistan, which goes horribly wrong, and which Willie will be on tomorrow's show talking about that. So I hope that this first half of today's episode has served basically to kind of set that up. So do make sure if you've, do make sure to tune into that episode tomorrow with Willie, because I hope we've kind of provided the setting for it. I think we should have a break now. And I think that when we come back, we should look at not the first Afghan war, because Willie will be talking about that, but about the second and third Afghan wars, and then the history of Afghanistan in the 20th century and into the 21st.
Yes, so, a very dark but fascinating story. So
we'll be back soon. See you then.
See you then.
From Cleopatra to Camilla Parker Bowles, and from Madame de Pompadour to Lola Montez, the other woman has been a staple of gossip throughout history. But who will make our list of the top 10 mistresses of all time? Some of them are famed for their beauty, some for their political acumen, and some for their prowess in selling oranges. Glamour, sophistication, intelligence, savoir-faire. Join us for an evening rich in all these qualities and more. Dominic and myself will be at the Rest is History Live at the London Podcast Festival, Friday, September the 10th at 7 p.m. Tickets cost £12.50 and can be bought at kingsplace.co.uk. kingsplace.co.uk. See you there. It appears that, as the result of two successful campaigns, of the employment of an enormous force and of the expenditure of large sums of money, all that has yet been accomplished has been the disintegration of the state, which it was desired to see strong, friendly, and independent. That was Lord Hartington, Secretary of State for India in the Liberal government, writing in 1880, after the second Afghan war of 1878 to 79. And Dominic, it has
uncanny
kind of echo there, isn't there?
Yeah, so, there is.
So, the second Afghan war, they go in, and basically it goes much better than the first one.
Yes. So the great game, basically, for people who don't know, is this sort of strange game of chess between Tsarist Russia, which is expanding to Central Asia, and British India. And the British in particular are paranoid about that the Russians are going to use Afghanistan as a kind of launch pad to attack
India.
Come
down through the Khyber Pass, as so many had done before.
So it becomes incredibly important to them to keep Afghanistan as this kind of, as a kind of neutral buffer state. And they're absolutely paranoid about Russian influence. So the first Afghan war, which we're going to be talking to Willie Dalrymple about tomorrow, they send this mission, which goes horribly wrong and becomes the great defining debacle of kind of mid-Victorian imperialism. It's this immortalized in paintings and literature and all that sort of stuff. Then the second war, now this is one that you don't often see referred to in kind of newspaper columns now, because it was a success, relative success anyway. They want to basically, the Russians have penetrated through Central Asia. They've taken Bukhara, they've taken Samarkand and Khiva and all these kind of Silk Road khanates. And the British want to force on the Afghans a British mission, so that basically the Russians won't have the ear of the Afghan king. And the Afghans say, well, no, we can quite happily live without British sort of diplomats in Kabul telling us what to do. So the British they have two goes. So in 1878, they have what seems to be a success, and they install a guy called Sir Lewis Cavagnari. But then he's massacred. So they have to come back in 1880. This is where Dr. Watson is involved, Sherlock Holmes, in the 5th Northumberland Fusiliers. He's shot in either the the leg or the shoulder, depending on which Conan Doyle story you read. It kind of, the bullet moves about during the Holmes canon. But this is actually quite successful. So the second mission is successful. And in 1893, there's a thing called the Durand Line, which is the line between Afghanistan and Pakistan.
I know all about this.
Do you? Is it something to do with cricket?
No, it isn't. It's to do with bird watching.
Right, that's an unexpected...
Yeah, it is. So it's, the Durand Line is named after Sir Mortimer Durand.
It is indeed.
He was the guy who did it.
Yeah.
And the reason that they commissioned him to do it was because he was a keen bird watcher. And so he could combine touring the mountains with bird watching.
Well, this is a fascinating thing. You know, everyone knows about the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the end of the First World War. But this is, again, one of these lines that the legacy lingers, because this divides the Pashtun people between the northwest frontier of what becomes Pakistan and Afghanistan. And actually, that creates a lingering sore in Afghan politics. So even in the 1970s, late as the 1970s, there are Afghan politicians who still want the revision of the Durand Line. And this explains, by the way, this is one of the factors in Pakistani intervention and influence in 1970s, 1980s Afghanistan.
Yeah, and it explains why it's impossible for Afghan politics to be divorced and separated from what's going on in northern Pakistan.
Exactly, because the Pakistani government are always going to be intervening, because they are always anxious about keeping that borderline. They don't want to lose those provinces to Afghanistan.
And it's all the fault of Sir Mortimer Durand, who came back from India, and he retired to Rock. He retired to Rock in Cornwall.
Sort of David Cameron holiday destination.
Yes, and wrote books about cormorants.
Right. So he lived happily ever after, anyway.
That's a classic British imperial story.
Yeah. So that's the Second Afghan War. That's Dr. Johnson's... Dr. Johnson fighting in an Afghan war. That's Dr. Watson's Afghan War. And it's after that that you have probably the single most famous thing ever written about Afghanistan, which is The Man Who Would Be King, Kipling's short story. So in that story, you have these two characters. I mean, you must know this, Tom. Peachy Kanha.
It's a fabulous story.
And Daniel Dravot. And off they go to Kafiristan, which, interestingly, in the story is pagan, and in reality was pagan. It was not yet.
So Kafirs are people who are non-Muslim.
Exactly. And there was a place called Kafiristan. It's now Nuristan. And famously, it all goes wrong. You know, and the story is often seen as this great metaphor for British imperialism. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But that kind of creates that image, doesn't it, of Afghanistan as lawless and as a place that
where adventurers can go and carve out a kingdom,
but it'll end horribly, and they'll be killed on a bridge and crucified, and all the terrible things that happen to the two characters, Michael Caine and Sean Connery. So then there's a third Afghan war, British Anglo-Afghan War. This is one that the Afghans actually unusually start. So at the end of the First World War, I don't know why they waited till the end of the First World War. I do not know. They'd had the best part of 5 years when they ought to have struck, and they wait till it's over, and then they decide to make their move when the British are no longer distracted. And it's really a sort of internal Afghan thing. There's a leader called Amanullah Khan, and he's trying to shore up his power base. So he decides to launch a little invasion of British India. The British hit back. They use air power. It's one of the first instances of bombing of a city. So a single plane goes and bombs Kabul. It causes great panic and terror among the local population. And it's a tactical British win. They fight back the invasion. But for the Afghans, it's quite a moment, because they've kind of gone toe-to-toe with the British. They have asserted their independence. They forced the British to agree that they'll no longer influence Afghanistan's foreign policy, which the British have been doing in the late Victorian, Edwardian period. And it sort of paves the way for... The interesting thing is that paves the way for actually what's quite a golden period for Afghanistan.
So Amanullah, I mean, he's a kind of almost an Ataturk figure, isn't he?
He wants to be.
Very interesting. I mean, you know, the irony is that they've banished the British, but actually he is the kind of, you know, he wants to westernize.
He does, exactly.
Afghanistan. And the totemic policy, which is obviously a fracture line that runs through modern Afghan history right the way up to the present day, is around the emancipation of women.
The veil in particular. You're absolutely right about education and the veil. And that runs right through Afghan history from Amanullah right through the most famous exponent, I suppose, one of the most famous is Mohammad Zahir Shah, who was king from 1933 to 73, who's another moderniser. And you can see Afghanistan, exactly as you say, in the context of other countries that are trying to do the same thing, that have this sort of, there's this pressure to modernise, to build universities, to build schools, to westernise, because Western values are seen by elites as modernity.
But also the inevitable kickback. So Amanullah gets kicked out, doesn't he?
He does indeed. There's a civil war at the end of the 1920s.
He's the first person to be airlifted out.
Yes.
So the British send a plane and get him out.
Exactly. So that's sort of setting up a bit of a template. But actually, you know what? Zahir Shah, who rules from 1933 to 73, he's pretty successful. So for 40 years, there is a much more gradual period of modernization. So they start to build universities, they import foreign advisors. This is the sort of heyday in the 60s of the hippie trail of Afghanistan being actually a peaceful place that you go on the way to India as a sort of sidetrack from India. In 1964, there's a constitution that has universal suffrage, that has women's rights, political parties, and so on. So Afghanistan is not by any means, it's not a basket case. It's not a kind of metaphor for violence and lawlessness in the sort of early Cold War, but as in so many places, pressures grow. You have university educated elites who are pushing for greater change. You have people in the countryside who are more resistant to change, who feel they're being left behind, who become anxious about what they see as corruption and so on. And so basically, in 1973, the king's cousin, who is a man called Mohammed Daoud Khan, who I think is a pretty disastrous figure in Afghan history, he launches a coup. So the king is away. He's gone to India for an eye operation, and he's gone to recuperate on the island of Ischia.
Of Italy, yeah.
Yes, and he's in Ischia, and his cousin launches this coup and sets himself up as... Now, you mentioned Ataturk. Daoud undoubtedly sees himself as a kind of Ataturk. He is going to be the father of the nation. I think he has a title like Father of the Nation or something. And he is going to drag Afghanistan, kicking and screaming, into the light of the kind of modern age. So scrapping the veil, for example, is one of his sort of trademark policies. And there's also an element of he's previously been quite a pro-Soviet figure. So Afghanistan has always trod a balancing, sort of trod a tightrope between the USA and the USSR in this period in the Cold War. And it's said of Daoud that he liked to light his American cigarettes with Soviet matches.
That's the way to balance the...
Yes.
The communist and the capitalist blocks, isn't it?
But I mean, as is often the way, you know, when you've had one coup, well, why not have another? He only lasts 5 years, and then the local communists turn against him. And then you have this incredibly confused, bizarre period where the communists, there's a local communist party, the PDPA, the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, is in charge. And it's under these fellas who are constantly plotting against each other and kind of killing each other. And the communist party itself is riven with factionalism. There are two main groups.
By this point, the monarchy has been terminated.
It's gone, yeah. Zahir Shah has been kicked out in 73, and it hasn't been. Daoud wasn't king, he was a dictator.
Right.
So the communist party itself, and this is really important, because it tees up some of what we see to this day, is divided between different groups. So there are two main factions. There's one called the Khalq, which is very popular among rural Pashtuns, the kind of people now who support the Taliban. And the other faction is called Parcham, and that's more popular among they're urban. They are Tajiks, Uzbeks, and so on. They're university educated. So you have that tension, which is right there.
Just like Brexit. Day.
Sorry?
Like Brexit.
That wasn't... yes. Yes, I suppose so. The Guardian readers and the Daily Express readers. Is that your sort of claim? Your
well, I'm just
into,
trying to put it in... You know,
into 70s Afghan
terms.
Politics.
Yes. It's a terrible comparison. Forget it.
Anyway, they all start killing each other, the leaders. So the first leader, Taraki, he is suffocated after a coup. And next guy comes in, Hafizullah Amin. He's got an MA in education from Columbia University.
Oh, fatal.
But he's a very bad man. He's a terrible... No, you'd think that makes him sort of slightly weak and weedy. Quite the opposite. Oh. He is a very brutal man. So he says, you know, we must really drag Afghanistan into the modern age. And he arrests tens of thousands of people. He has a personality cult. Now, here's a really interesting and important thing that will surprise some listeners, I think. The Soviet Union are not at all encouraging this. They don't like this at all.
Why not?
Because they can, I mean, the people in the Soviet Union in the late 70s, they're all aged 184.
They're all got colds.
They're kind of Brezhnev, Gromyko, Kosygin. They're old men. And they know, you know, you don't rush things, you don't charge in. They're actually very small C conservative. And they're constantly saying to Armin, don't do all this. This is madness. You know, you're going to completely upset everything. You're going to provoke a massive reaction.
And do you think because I think it isn't Macmillan is advising Douglas Home, don't invade Afghanistan. I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's a kind of passing message from British Prime Minister to his successor.
Right.
Don't invade Afghanistan.
Whatever you do, don't.
Whatever you do, don't.
Surely
do
very little chance of Sir Alec Douglas Home invading Afghanistan.
Well, exactly. But this is obviously a kind of, you know, it's Prime Minister from Prime Minister. Yeah. Don't invade Afghanistan. It's the same thing.
It's absolutely
kind of folk
true.
Memory in Russia. You know, invade it.
But this is a complete misapprehension in the West and continues to this day that the Soviet Union invades Afghanistan because they're kind of, you know, they're like Hitler in the 1930s. This is not the case at all. Armin is constantly saying, because his policies provoke such resistance in the Afghan countryside, and it creates a massive insurgency. And he's constantly saying to the Kremlin, send me loads of troops. Come and help me kill all these people. And the Kremlin constantly saying, no, this is the last thing we want to do is get involved in Afghanistan. I mean, at one point, the KGB decide this guy's a complete loose cannon. This is 1979. This guy's a complete loose cannon. We'll get his chef. They get a chef to poison him. But disastrously, they don't tell the Soviet embassy. So the Soviet doctors save him. So after he's been poisoned by his chef. So we get to the end of 1979. It's all really kind of everything's going to pot. Now, already the United States and Pakistan are funding the insurgency. So this is before that a single Soviet tank has rolled across the river.
And the insurgency is Islamist.
Yes. So Islam is obviously it's not purely Islamist. Islam is a huge part of it. And Islam proves a very good way of transcending the tribal and ethnic divisions. I mean, that's the power of Islamism.
And the class traditions.
And the class, exactly. So Islam is what binds you in opposition to the infidel invader.
But as you say, really important to emphasize that the divisions are not just between Islam and secular modernity.
Not.
It's class, ethnic. I mean,
rural
and urban.
All those things run through Afghan history or modern Afghan history. So you get to the end of 1979. Now, the conversations the Soviet guys have are so fascinating. You can read about them online in declassified documents. They know it's like Vietnam. They absolutely know that. And for a long time, the Red Army and the KGB, their analysts have been saying, the last thing we should do is send troops to Afghanistan. This would be a very, very bad move. And again, Gromyko and Kosygin, who are the two kind of, I mean, Brezhnev is basically a walking corpse. So they're the kind of decision makers. They say, no, this is a very, very bad idea. We shouldn't do it. And the reason they do it, Tom, is because they're so alarmed by the insurgency and by Pakistani and US funding for the insurgency. But also the Iranian Revolution has happened by now.
Yeah, of course.
So they're worried about Islamism coming up through Afghanistan into Central Asia. So they invade Afghanistan as the least worst option. And the plan is, you know, they don't want to conquer it and kind of sow salt in the ruins of Kabul and parade the skulls of their defeated enemies. All they want to do is get in, kill Armin, who's clearly a complete head case, install a friendly government, get out and forget all about it. And as we all know, some of them had feared. It goes
Rambo
horrendously. Or well, James Bond gets involved in the Living Daylights.
Yeah, so the elite Dalton. Of the American spy agencies and special forces. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a horrible, horrible war. The Soviet Union at their peak have 110,000 troops in 1985. It's a classic Vietnam pattern. They hold the cities. They launch search and destroy missions with helicopters. But it doesn't really work, partly because of the terrain that we've talked about, partly because, you know, as we've seen in the last 20 years, particularly in the countryside, a lot of people just hate the thought of a corrupt urban government following the orders of its kind of foreign puppet masters. You get Muslim volunteers coming in funded by Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, most famously Osama bin Laden. You get American. I mean, the Americans are putting in at the peak $600 million a year. This guy Charlie Wilson. Charlie Wilson's war is paid by Tom Hanks.
Yeah, and they're all the people who subsequently will be excoriated as the enemies of America are fated as friends of freedom. And
yeah, absolutely. I mean, at one point Reagan welcomes Mujahideen to the White House. Yeah. Now these are not the Taliban. A lot of these people are the people the Taliban will be fighting against. But basically,
well, they're warlords, aren't they?
They're warlords.
They're kind of feudal figures, a lot of them.
Exactly. They're kind of tribal leaders, gangsters. But I mean, warlords is exactly the word.
I mean, the classic one is Marshal Dostum.
Yeah, he changes sides about every... I mean, he's still involved now, isn't he? He changes sides about once every 2 years.
The Taliban occupied his palace and were, you know, turning the gold taps and things.
But I mean, he has changed sides so often. He's an Uzbek. And he has changed sides. He's very popular in the Uzbek community, but I think...
In northern Afghanistan. So there's also the geography kicks in again, that the Taliban heartlands are in the south, right?
Yeah, and, exactly, around Kandahar.
So
the Russian invasion, I mean, it's utterly brutalizing for all involved. It definitely sort of destabilizes things in Russia itself, and particularly in Ukraine, about 1 in 4 of the Red Army soldiers are Ukrainians. But the casualties are enormous. I mean, you know, there's at least 1 million Afghans. Some say 2 million die. Actually, among the Soviets, the official figures say about 14,000, but it's probably much more. It's just a horrible, horrible war. As
and
Vietnam
it ends
was.
Horribly, doesn't it? With it does Najibullah.
Yes. Although he lasted longer, I have to say. I mean, quite a few people have pointed this out online in recent days. The Russian, the Soviet... client regime lasts longer than the coalition backed.
But he ends up being tortured and castrated.
He does.
And hung from a telegraph pole.
Yeah, although he falls, there's a slight hiatus, a slight confusing story. He's toppled, but then he hangs around Najibullah, and he does an extraordinary thing, actually, Tom. He hangs around after he's toppled in 1992 by the warlords, but then he hangs around in Kabul translating the works of Peter Hopkirk into English.
That's unexpected.
Yeah, he comes really interested in Afghan history, translates The Great Game. The Taliban pitch up in 1996, and as you say, they mutilate, torture, castrate him, and that's the end of him. So people often say the Taliban are medieval, but that's not right. The Taliban are very modern. The Taliban originate in reaction to the chaos of the Soviet war and its aftermath, and in particular the warlordism. So they've got appeal among ethnic Pashtuns. Their appeal among people who think there's too much corruption. The sort of depredations of the warlords. They provide basic services.
There's also a kind of class element.
Yeah, and of course
they are the people rising up against the effete elites.
Yeah,
and there's also a kind of weird sexual dimension to it that often doesn't get covered in the Western press, where the narrative is almost entirely about women and the way in which women are secluded under the Taliban. It's notorious. It's the thing that the Taliban are most notorious for. But of course, what that also means is that men are separated from women. And so there's this lengthy tradition in Afghanistan, you know, and this kind of seclusion of women is one that goes back many, many centuries, of men taking young boys and training them as dancers. And the boys kind of dress up in, you know, female dancing silks and bells and things. And this is kind of an accepted part of Afghan culture. But the warlords who defeat the communists in that incredibly brutal war, they use this tradition basically as a way to kind of engage in paedophile rape. And so for large numbers of Taliban supporters, the anxiety is what's going to happen not to their daughters, but to their sons. And Mullah Omar, I mean, the kind of the foundational myth around the emergence of the Taliban is that he takes two men who are raping a boy and he executes them. He hangs them. And this is what kind of provides lights the moral fuse that enables the Taliban to burst. And this is something that has been a kind of rumbling source of discontent in Afghanistan throughout the period of the American occupation, is that basically the Americans have been turning a blind eye to the way in which a lot of their kind of Afghan supporters have been carrying on this tradition.
Well, I think that the story of the Taliban for a historian is a fascinating story, because clearly, you know, they haven't survived for as long as they have. They haven't survived defeat by the Americans, or apparent defeat in 2001, and then all this long period of the insurgency, just because they are sort of supervillains. They have an appeal. They're rooted in that kind of southern Afghan, Pashtun, rural kind of heartland. But also their Islamism allows them to bring in other people as well. So people who've been radicalized and so on. And as you say, I mean, I read a fascinating report yesterday by the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. They've written in 2009, very prescient, in which the author, who is a French specialist on the Taliban called Gilles Daronsoro, he basically says, you know, the Taliban, we're completely underestimating them. They're anti-corruption. They provide rural services. They have the rhetoric of resistance to infidel invaders. They play on people's distrust of the cities and of modernity. And obviously they appeal to people's kind of rural, ethnic, kind of traditional identity. And that's something that clearly has had an appeal and had a potency that the coalition forces just never really managed to overcome.
But, and the coalition forces were always playing the game that previous colonial invasions have played, which is to occupy the cities.
Yeah.
The, you know, Afghans don't want to meet modern westernized armies in the field. I mean, that's true going all the way back to 1842. They melt into the countryside, and then they just, you know, slowly throttle the cities.
Yeah.
And that's basically what's happened this time around as well.
And also, of course, all the money that flowed into Afghanistan, the aid money, the American money and so on, it created a great sense of corruption, which again played into everything that the Taliban had been saying since the 1990s. And of course, it's true.
Well, you know, they had this incredible slogan on the Ministry for Prevention of Vice and Promotion of Virtue. Throw reason to the dogs. It stinks of corruption.
Wow. Yeah. Very anti-enlightenment.
Yes.
So, Tom, obviously we've gone on far too long and it's been a real whistle-stop tour, but I think it would be weird to end without a few reflections about intervention and imperialism. So do you think it has been a failure, there's no doubt about it. I mean, there's no way you can spin it as a success. Joe Biden was always against continuing with the Afghan occupation and the intervention. He famously was a critic of it from a quite an early stage. Do you think he's right? Do you think he's been do you think the collapse of the Afghan government proves that intervention just doesn't work, Western intervention in this way?
I don't feel qualified to opine on that, because I don't know enough about the state of Afghanistan to know whether it would have been possible for a stable government to be established, for some of the corruption and the things that were offensive to many Afghans to be cured. I don't know whether it would have been possible for those routes to go down had the Americans retained their presence there. But I have no doubt that it was an imperial venture. I mean, it seems to me absolutely part of a continuum reaching back, to the first Afghan war.
Yeah.
And in a sense, the great trauma in the West is what will happen to women. And that's been a bone of contention in Afghanistan, as we've said, for at least a century. It's the kind of the great lightning rod for tension between westernized elites and people out in the fields. And the in a sense, that fusion of kind of realpolitik, we've got to be in Afghanistan to stop Al-Qaeda bedding down or whatever, and we've got to be in Afghanistan to promote the cause of female emancipation and to preserve gender equality. That is absolutely part of the imperial tradition.
It is.
It's the fusion of idealism and realpolitik that was part of British imperialism and remains today part of American imperialism.
But it's arguably a weakness, I would say. If you're half idealistic, half realpolitik, you can sort of fall between two stools. I mean, what I would say is either you do it properly or you don't do it at all. And I think, you know, we talked before about the United States in a previous podcast. The United States is an anti-imperialist empire.
Yeah.
Or was anti-imperialist imperialism. And in a way, you know, had they gone in 2001 and said, we don't care if you call us imperialists. Basically, we're here for 50 years, maybe here forever. We're going to treat Afghanistan as a colony and we will rule with ruthless determination or whatever. You know, they'd still be there now.
Well, because as we've said, you know, it's perfectly possible to conquer Afghanistan.
Yeah.
If you kind of frog march people carrying the soil of their native city and then mix it with their blood.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, the option is always there. We weren't going to do that. But I do think it's striking that, you know, back in the homeland, particularly the American homeland, opposition to imperialism is probably more passionate than it's ever been. And yeah. In Britain as well. I mean, imperialism has become a completely dirty word. And yet, at the same time...
Yes. Well, you can go down somebody's timeline, Tom, Twitter timeline, and tweet A, sent at 8 a.m., says, we really need to hurry up with decolonizing this curriculum and demolishing the statue of a Victorian general. And tweet B, sent 20 minutes later, says...
We've got to do something about...
We must do something about Afghanistan. It's shameful that we've run away. And you sort of think, well, come on.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a clear contradiction here. And I suppose it's... I mean, it's...
And I'm sure the Taliban... We're aware of those contradictions. I mean, they...
Do you think, been following the decolonization of the curriculum argument?
I think that some of them are kind of sophisticated spokesmen.
Well, they are much more sophisticated
who are now
than
on
people.
Twitter, yes. Unlike, say, Donald Trump, are, you know, I think they're perfectly capable of, obviously, of working out what the state of morale is in Washington.
Yeah. I mean, I actually think the parallels... You know, I'm so glad we did that Vietnam podcast before this because I think the parallels are uncannily similar, and just as they were in the Soviet invasion. And the irony is that, you know, George W. Bush and Tony Blair said, we have absolutely learned the lessons of the past. We've definitely not repeating the mistakes of the Soviet invasion. And yet the Soviet client state survived longer after the departure of Soviet troops.
Well, I think that photo of the helicopter over the American embassy will appear on the cover of many, many textbooks.
Yes, it will indeed.
The decline of America and the decline of the West.
It will indeed. Right. So that's the broad sweep. Tomorrow we'll go deep into the most famous episode, I think, of imperial failure in Afghanistan, which is the first Anglo-Afghan War. I mean, welcome back, William Dalrymple. Tom, are you hoping for a word in edgeways this time?
No, I don't think there's any point because Willie, the story that he has to tell is such an extraordinary one, and he is so well qualified to tell it that I feel it would be presumption on my part to intrude in any way. There is one last thing I would like to say, which is that on the topic of Western imperial engagements and the damage that they can do, on Monday and Tuesday, that's the 23rd and 24th, I will be doing a walk. I'll be walking 50 miles in 24 hours. And among the causes that I'm raising money for is the cause of Yazidi refugees. Yazidi is a religious minority in northern Iraq who basically have had an absolutely terrible time of it recently and can't go back to their homes. So if you could in any way find it in yourselves to support that walk, the details are on my pinned tweet, which is @Holland_Tom, and the links are there. So thanks very much for that.
It's a great cause. Do please support the Ian Botham of History Podcasting.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.